to his father, who was responsible for its harlequin appearance, but to his mother, who first flushed crimson, then looked as if she might burst into tears, then ran into her bedroom, slammed the door, and did. Later, red-eyed, she explained to Miles that what was on the inside of a house, love, she seemed to have in mind, was more important than what was on the outside, paint, preferably in one hue. But after Miles went to bed, he heard his parents arguing, and after that night, Max never painted the house again. Now its motley color scheme had weathered into uniform gray. Miles hadn't been parked across the street for more than a minute, staring up at the dark, shadeless window of the room where his mother had begun her death march, before a police car wheeled around the corner, two blocks up long, and came toward him, swerving across the street and rocking to a halt so close that its bumper was mere inches from the Jetta's own grill. A young policeman was at the wheel, one Miles didn't recognize, and when he got out of the cruiser, putting on sunglasses that the gloomy sky didn't warrant, Miles rolled down his window. "License and registration," the young cop said. "Is there a problem, officer?" "License and registration," the cop repeated, his tone a little harder this time. Miles fished the registration out of the glove box and handed it out the window along with his license. The policeman attached both to the top of his clipboard and made a couple notes. "You mind telling me what you're doing here, Mr. Roby?" "Yes, I do," said Miles, who would have been reluctant to, even if he'd had an explanation that made any sense. That a demented priest had called his mother a whore, thereby compelling him to visit the house he'd grown up in, as if his mother, dead these 20 years, might be rocking on the porch, did not strike Miles as the sort of story that would satisfy a man who felt compelled to wear sunglasses on dark, rainy afternoons. "Why is that, Mr. Roby?" To Miles, this didn't sound like a serious question, so he didn't answer it. The young policeman scratched some more on his form. "Maybe you didn't hear the question," he finally said. "Have I done something illegal?" Now it was the cop's turn to fall silent. For a full minute, he ignored Miles, apparently to prove that he too could play this silence game. "Are you aware that you're driving an unregistered vehicle, Mr. Roby?" "I believe you have the registration in your hand. Expired last month. I'll have to take care of it." The cop didn't register this remark, instead pointing at the inspection sticker on the windshield. "Your inspection's also past due." "I guess I'll have to take care of that, too." No opinion on this either. "So what are you doing here, Mr. Roby?" the officer said, as if he were asking this question for the first time. "I used to live in that house," Miles said, indicating which one. "Used to, but not now." "That's right." Miles then caught a glimpse of something red in his rearview mirror and turned in time to see Jimmy Minty's red Camaro pulling up behind him. Jimmy, who'd grown up next door, was about the last person Miles would have wanted to catch him parked just here. When Jimmy rolled down his window, the young cop abruptly walked back to the Camaro. Miles watched their conversation in the mirror, smiling when the officer took off his dark glasses. In such situations, apparently only the ranking officer got to keep his glasses on. The conversation was short. Then Jimmy Minty did a U-turn and headed back down the street in the direction he'd come from. The young officer, clearly disappointed, watched him go, then returned to Miles and handed back his license and registration. "Might be a good idea to take care of these today," he said, the confrontational edge gone from his voice now. "You're not citing me?" "Not unless you think I should, Mr. Roby." Miles put the license back in his wallet, the registration back in the glove compartment. Now that they were pals, the cop seemed anxious that there should be no hard feelings. "You lived in that house there?" Miles nodded, slipping the Jetta in gear. "Huh," the young cop said. "Looks haunted." The Motor Vehicles Division office was being run out of the Whiting Mansion, or rather, the cottage, a large outbuilding nestled in a grove of trees behind the main house. This arrangement was only temporary, until renovations at the courthouse, whose domed roof had partially collapsed after last winter's ice storm, were completed. Since then, justice, never swift in Empire Falls, had ground to a virtual halt. Except for traffic court, most legal matters were being processed out of nearby Fairhaven, whose docket had grown so crowded with the legal business of both towns that everything from building permits to property disputes to small claims to assessments was backed up for months. Even the simplest legal transactions, like Miles' uncontested divorce, seemed endlessly bogged down. Since he hadn't wanted the divorce to begin with, he wasn't terribly troubled. In fact, last spring he'd hoped the holdup might cause Janine to reconsider, though by now he knew that she was determined to marry the Silver Fox, and that somehow she held this legal delay, which had ruined her plans for a summer wedding, against Miles. So determined was she to marry Walt Como the moment her divorce became final, that Miles had begun to suspect that in some part of her brain, the workings of which still mystified him, Janine realized that this second marriage was some pure folly she needed to commit quickly, lest she come to her senses first. Miles parked in the small lot between the main house, now headquarters of the Dexter County Museum and Historical Society, and the cottage, which housed, in addition to the temporary DMV, the permanent offices of the Empire Falls Planning and Development Commission, which over the last decade had become something of a joke, since no one had developed anything in Empire Falls during that period, nor was anyone planning to. Mrs. Whiting, as director of the board, kept an office there, however, and when Miles saw her Lincoln parked in the lot, he hurried across the lawn, head down, in the hope that she wouldn't spy him out her window. He'd been avoiding the state of the grill since his return from vacation, and despite the restaurant's improved business, he was even more reluctant than usual to spend an afternoon going over receipts and making projections. Safely inside, he joined a short line and awaited his turn at a window marked Auto Reg. The entire mahogany counter, he realized, had been transported from the courthouse and would no doubt be ferried back again. The other furnishings, including the paintings and photographs of Whiting males that decorated the walls, all belonged to the museum collection. Miles studied these men while he waited. For direct lineal descendants, they didn't look all that much alike, except, Miles decided, for one feature. Even as young men, they appeared prematurely old, or maybe just distinguished, their hair white, their brows chiseled in cogitation. Or perhaps they were reflecting with satisfaction that the history of Empire Falls, indeed of Dexter County, was little more than the history of their own family. After a few minutes, he noticed Jimmy Minty's red Camaro pull into the lot. Leaving the car idling, the police officer got out and came toward the cottage, angling off the walkway that led to motor vehicles and proceeding across the lawn to the back of the building. Miles followed his progress until a man behind him in line tapped him on the shoulder and pointed out that it was his turn. At the window, he wrote out the check for his new tags and slipped it through the opening. When the woman on the other side of the glass smiled and said, "Hello, Miles," he recognized her as a girl he'd gone to high school with, Marcia, according to her name tag. Which was more likely, he wondered, that he and Marcia should have lived so long in such a small town without running into each other, or that he and Jimmy Minty would cross paths twice in half an hour? "You keep this car another year or two, and we'll have to pay you to register it," the clerk observed, when she saw the amount of the check he'd written out. "That would be fine with me, Marcia," Miles told her, hoping she'd conclude that he'd remembered her name across the long span of years. "Here's your new chickadee plates," she said, pushing a pair through the opening. "What was wrong with the lobster ones?" "People from out of state made fun of them, said the lobsters looked like cockroaches." Miles studied the new plates, which didn't strike him as much of an improvement, though the lobsters had looked like cockroaches. "I hope this doesn't mean we have to start eating chickadees." "It may come to that if things don't start looking up," she said. "I hear there might be a buyer for the mill, though." Miles considered asking where she'd heard this. After all, the Planning and Development Commission office was only a few feet away, so it was possible she might have overheard something genuine. More likely, however, was that she'd overheard somebody standing in this very line. Somebody who'd had coffee that morning at the Empire Grill. Through another window, Jimmy Minty could now be seen standing on the doorstep of the Empire Falls Planning and Development Commission office, conversing with someone who, because of the angle, was invisible, though Miles immediately concluded that it had to be Mrs. Whiting. The policeman's body language told the story. He was listening with much the same attitude as the younger policeman had listened to him half an hour earlier, and this time it was Minty who removed his dark glasses. Miles watched as he nodded once, twice, three times, apparently at specific instructions. Was it Miles' imagination, or did Minty glance quickly into the motor vehicle's office and then away again, as if he'd been told not to? "Don't you think?" Marcia was saying. "I'm sorry," Miles said, returning his attention to her. "Don't I think what?" "I said it's about time our luck changed around here." "It sure is," Miles agreed. "Assuming it's luck that's the problem, of course," which he privately doubted. The problem with trying to gauge mathematical probability was that it presupposed the circumstance you were observing was governed by chance. Outside, Jimmy Minty nodded one last time before recrossing the lawn to his idling Camaro and pulling back out onto Empire Avenue. Miles waited until he'd turned the corner before tucking his new license plates under his arm and heading for the door. Before he could complete his escape, though, Marcia's phone rang, and he heard her say, "Yes, it is," and then call his name. He thought he might just keep going, pretending not to hear. Then he thought again. Mrs. Whiting was on the phone when he knocked and entered, but she acknowledged his presence by pointing to a chair. Miles, however, was reluctant to sit down before scanning the room for the old woman's frequent companion, a vicious black cat named Timmy. Miles was allergic to cats in general, and Mrs. Whiting's in particular. It was a rare encounter between the two that didn't leave Miles striped and puffy. Mrs. Whiting smiled and put her hand over the phone. "You can relax," she assured him. "I left Timmy at home." "Are you sure?" Miles wondered, still far from at ease. The cat in question, in Miles' opinion, possessed many borderline supernatural abilities, including a talent for materializing at will. "That's hilarious, dear boy," she replied, then resumed her conversation on the phone. Their 20-year relationship, Miles often thought, could be summed up in those four words. From the beginning, when Miles and her daughter Cindy were in high school together, Mrs. Whiting had referred to him as "dear boy," though Miles doubted he was particularly dear to her in any way, and she was forever pronouncing things he said hilarious, despite a demeanor that suggested she didn't find them even remotely funny. The Planning and Development Commission office, which Miles had never entered before, was large, and along one whole wall sat a scale model of downtown Empire Falls, so obviously idealized that he didn't immediately recognize it as the town he'd lived his whole life in. The streets were lined with bright green toy trees, and the buildings so brightly painted, the streets so clean, that Miles' first thought was that this was an artist's notion of what a future Empire Falls might look like after an ambitious and costly revitalization project. Only closer inspection revealed that the model represented not the future, but the past. This, Miles realized, was the Empire Falls of his own childhood, and he noticed several businesses along Empire Avenue that had been razed over the last two decades, leaving in real life a rash of excess parking lots. The Empire Grill, neglected in real life, in miniature looked as if Mrs. Whiting had given Miles every penny he'd ever asked for. A small silver plate on the base read, "Empire Falls, circa 1959. The actual town, of course, had never looked quite so prosperous. Even in 1959, the brick walls of the textile mill and the shirt factory, bright red on the model, had gone rust brown, even black in some places, with weather and soot, and the river that ran past them on the model had been rendered sky blue. Now that's hilarious, Miles thought. Surely the only time in the last 100 years that the Knox had run blue was when the textile mill was dumping blue dye into it. Even more hilarious was the idea that such a nostalgic past should have found a home in the town's planning and development office. Evidently, the commission's plan was to turn back the clock. Elijah Whiting, whose stern portrait overlooked the model, failed to see the humor in any of this. Like the Whitings in the other room, old Elijah wore a grim expression, and he had the same weakness about the mouth. They all reminded Miles of someone, though he couldn't imagine who. When Mrs. Whiting said goodbye and hung up, she did it so perfunctorily that Miles couldn't help wondering whether she'd really been on the phone or was just using the pretense to study him. Around her, this feeling of being scrutinized was not unusual. She now rotated in her chair, leaned back, and regarded Elijah Whiting. "They were all mad as hatters, you know, in one way or another. You can see it lurking behind the eyes if you look." Miles did look, though he didn't see what he was supposed to. There was a quality of zealousness, perhaps, of bigotry maybe, but not of insanity. "You probably heard the stories about this distinguished ancestor when you were a boy."
"I don't think so."
"He's said to have chased his wife around this very room with a shovel, intent on bashing in a skull."
"Surely nothing like that ever happened here," Miles said, indicating the model, in which only the Whiting estate didn't look different in quality from its appearance in real life. It suddenly occurred to Miles that Mrs. Whiting herself must have commissioned it. By idealizing the rest of the town, she had successfully obscured the truth that its wealth and vitality had been bled dry by the generations of a single family. A cynical interpretation, perhaps, but it also explained why the house C.B. Whiting had built across the river was not represented on the model at all. Across the iron bridge was virgin wilderness, all lush trees and rolling hills.
"Seeing you standing there gives me an inspiration," the old woman said, though Miles doubted, even before she continued, that her sudden intuition would be anything like his own. "You should be mayor."
"Of the model?" Miles smiled. "I could just about afford that." Being mayor of Empire Falls was a full-time job with a part-time salary, though it was often remarked that past mayors had found ways to supplement their income.
"You're too modest, dear boy. I've often thought you should run for political office."
Miles decided not to remind her that he'd run for school board twice and been elected.
"Are you offering me the job?" "You overestimate the extent of my influence, dear boy," she smiled. "You're rather like your mother in that respect. But then people are forever confusing will with power, don't you find? I have a theory about why, if you're interested."
"Why I'm like my mother?" Miles asked, finally taking his seat. "Or why people confuse will with power?"
"The latter," she said. "After all, there's nothing very mysterious about why you take after your mother, is there? Your father isn't exactly the sort of man who inspires imitation. No, people confuse power with will because so few of them have the foggiest idea what they want. Absent any knowledge, will remains impotent. A limp dick, as it were."
She regarded him, eyebrow arched.
"The lucky few who happen actually to know what they want are said to have will power."
"That's all it takes?"
"Well, let's call it a necessary beginning."
Miles allowed himself to settle into his chair. More than anyone he knew, Mrs. Whiting had the ability to draw him into conversations he otherwise would have avoided. The reason seemed to be that her conclusions were invariably antithetical to his own. "So you think human beings are meant to know what they want?" Mrs. Whiting sighed.
"That word, meant, suggests you're up to your old tricks, dear boy, casting everything in a religious light. That won't do if you intend to be mayor."
"I don't," he pointed out. Certainly not if Empire falls in 1959. But that's where you're foolish, dear boy. Most Americans want it to be 1959, with the addition of cappuccino and cable TV. That's what they want or what they think they want. The person he was thinking of was Janine. His soon-to-be ex-wife was never uncertain about what she wanted, just disappointed by its eventual acquisition. Miles himself had been an example. The Silver Fox, though he didn't yet suspect it, would be another. That's not a particularly helpful distinction, is it? What is wanting but thinking? But for the sake of argument, let's accept your terms and begin at the beginning. Adam and Eve. They knew what they wanted, did they not? I doubt it, Miles said, also for the sake of argument, until it was forbidden. Precisely, dear boy, but once it was forbidden, they suffered no such doubts, am I correct? No, just regrets. Do you imagine that refusing the forbidden fruit would have made them happier? Would that have eliminated regret or merely redefined it? She had a point. I guess we'll never know. I certainly won't, dear boy. But like our progenitors, I've not resisted many temptations. You, on the other hand. She dangled the thought. Mrs. Whiting had never made any secret that she considered Miles a case study in repression. Did you have a nice vacation? Wonderful, he said, eager for the old woman to understand that fine times could be had by others. Mrs. Whiting studied him carefully, as if suspicious that his enthusiasm masked a falsehood. You return there every summer, don't you? Just about. Has it occurred to you to wonder why? No, he told her. When not insinuating that he was repressed, the old woman liked to imply that despite his intelligence, his views were parochial, the result of his having traveled and seen so little. Like many rich people, she seemed not to understand why the poor didn't think to winter in Capri, where the weather was more clement. Nor did it strike her as unfair to suggest as much to a man who for 20 years had tended one of her businesses while she traveled. "I've got friends who have a house there," he continued, leaving unsaid what Mrs. Whiting no doubt understood perfectly well, that only charity made even so modest a vacation possible. Actually, it was Miles who had introduced Peter and Dawn to the vineyard all those years ago, during college. They'd all been poor then, and when they pooled their resources that fall, they'd had just about enough to pay for the ferry crossing. They'd slept on the beach illegally, beneath the cliffs at Gayhead, confident that after Labor Day they wouldn't be rousted by the island police, who probably numbered no more than half a dozen. It was during this weekend on the island, Miles suspected, that Peter and Dawn had fallen in love, first with the island and then with each other. Since then, they'd considered Miles instrumental to their happiness and were grateful to him for it, even if their affection for each other had begun to wear thin, as he feared. Clearly, they both still loved the vineyard. He couldn't imagine either one of them conceding the house in a divorce settlement. "Yes, well, that makes sense," Mrs. Whiting grudgingly acknowledged. "And yet..." "And yet what?" She appeared to lose her train of thought, but only momentarily. "And yet, we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past." The old woman was smiling at him knowingly, and Miles, who recognized the final line of The Great Gatsby, felt an intense obligation to reveal neither this nor the slightest curiosity about her intention. When the phone rang, both were visibly relieved. Mrs. Whiting picked up the receiver and waved goodbye in one efficient motion, dismissing Miles without further ceremony. A hell of a way, Miles thought, to treat someone you'd just encouraged to run for mayor. Chapter 3. When Janine finished her last aerobics class, she showered quickly and drove over to the Empire Grill, circling the block to make sure Miles wasn't there. Even though the divorce was dragging on forever, the whole thing had been amicable enough. In fact, She'd liked Miles better these last 9 months since they decided to separate than at any time in the previous 20 years. Still, she had no desire to see him right now, especially not in the company of her fiancé. It was genuinely weird the way Walt had begun hanging out at the grill, a place he totally avoided when they were sneaking around. Pulling in and parking next to Walt's van, she made a point of not looking at the stencil logo, not wanting to admit that it was beginning to irritate her. The Silver Fox. What sort of man would write that on his car? For Janine, this question was neither idle nor rhetorical. She was going to marry Walt Como as soon as the divorce was final, and part of her wanted to know the answer to that question before she became half-owner of the vehicle and sole owner of the driver. Then again, some questions were better left unanswered. She knew Walt pretty well, certainly better than she'd known Miles. Back when they got married, she hadn't even known who she was, her own self, never mind her intended. At least now Janine knew who Janine was, what Janine wanted, and just as important, what Janine didn't want. She didn't want Miles, or anyone who reminded her of Miles. She didn't want to be fat anymore either. Never, ever again. Also, she wanted a real sex life, and she wanted to act young for a change, something she hadn't been able to do when she actually was young. She wanted to dance and have men look at her. She liked the way her body felt after dropping all that weight, and by God, she liked to come. For Janine, at 40, orgasms were a new thing, and she damn near lost her mind every time she had another, or when she contemplated how close she'd come to going her whole life without experiencing that singular, incomparable, tingling, explosive, mind-bending thrill. The first one had caught her by surprise that at the height of the wave she went someplace very far away, then returned, sobbing in Walt's arms, having concluded she'd never get to go there again, though he assured her she would, and then made damn sure she did. Damn, she remembered thinking. I mean, damn. It was Walt Como who taught her about herself and her body's needs, though she was beginning to realize that even Walt's views on the matter were oversimplified. To his way of thinking, what her body needed was lots of exercise and lots of Walt. Janine herself was wondering if her body might not benefit from a little travel. She didn't mind working out at Walt's own club, but she'd read somewhere about a spa out in the desert near Tucson, Arizona, that specialized in women's bodies. Luxurious was the word the brochure used. And now that Janine was beginning to feel luxurious about her body, she thought she deserved a week or two at a place like that. It was expensive, sure, but Walt was always going on about all his money, and she kept hoping to talk him into honeymooning there. And once Tick graduated from high school, what would prevent them from relocating to a warmer climate? After living in Maine all her life, it'd be nice to be someplace where the sun came out and stayed out. Walt was always talking about opening up a new health club, so why not Sedona or Santa Fe? If what she heard was true, the desert Southwest was like California. People kept fit and healthy and wore bathing suits that were basically symbolic of clothing. If Walt didn't want to at least check it out, Janine wouldn't mind going by herself for a week. She'd liked the look of the Latino masseurs in the brochure, which seemed a little ungrateful, she had to admit. After all, Walt had been the one who woke her up, who helped her locate herself, the person she really was. And he also located that wonderful spot, found it right away, the one Miles never suspected the existence of. Now here she was thinking about Latino masseurs. If only he just hadn't stenciled those stupid words on the side of the van, Janine thought, as she got out of her blazer. Probably stupid wasn't the right spin. They weren't stupid so much as boastful, she decided, heading for the front door of the restaurant. Besides, wasn't it Walt's cockiness that had attracted her in the first place? The fact that he was so different from Miles, who was so docile. Her mother, of course, still loved Miles and sided with him on all occasions, referring to Walt as that little banty rooster. Miles is modest for good reason, Ma, believe me, she assured her mother. A mean thing to say, maybe, but true. and had hinted at what there was no way to discuss with B, the whole sex thing. Her mother, Janine felt certain, was one of those poor women who'd managed to do what Janine herself had damn near done. She'd lived her entire adult life from one end to the other without a single orgasm. When B died, it would be possible to say truthfully that she went before she came, not Janine. If she'd been the sort of person to stencil anything on the side of a van, it'd be something more like, she came before she went. Which meant, she supposed, that she and Walt Como were made for each other, and she ought to quit thinking about the strong hands of Latino masseurs. "Hey, babe," she said, sliding onto a stool next to the man she'd be married to next month, if her idiot lawyer was to be believed. Unless the roof of the Fairhaven courthouse fell in too, which wouldn't surprise Janine one bit. Not the way everything had been conspiring against her right from the start, when she made the mistake of telling that priest with the Alzheimer's all about herself and Walt, figuring he'd forgive her and then forget all about it. Everyone said he couldn't remember twice around, which was why they'd finally had to hire the younger priest. Except that this time the old guy remembered three or four times around. He told Miles everything she'd said in the confessional, and then, forgetting he'd told him again the next day. Still, now that it was almost over, Janine figured it was probably just as well the old nitwit had squealed on her. At the time, she'd been confused about what she wanted, or else she wouldn't have gone to a priest at all. Once everything was out in the open, it occurred to her that what she wanted was Walt, and for the two of them to make up for all the sex she'd been cheated out of. If that meant everybody thought she was a slut, including her daughter and her own mother, then they could just think whatever they wanted. In a sense, it was good she and Walt got caught, because if they hadn't, Walt, being a man, probably would have been just as happy to keep on with the hanky-panky. It was Janine who hadn't liked all the sneaking around, and getting caught had at least set the legal ball rolling, which was something. Keeping it rolling had required all her energy, except for what she kept in reserve for sex and the Stairmaster. The last 9 months had proved one thing beyond a shadow of a doubt. You can't beat City Hall the same year its roof falls in. Walt was intently playing gin with Horace, so he didn't notice when she came in. Another thing that was beginning to bother Janine was the way Walt knitted his brow over anything that taxed his intellect. Quite a lot did, Janine had to admit. So she had plenty of opportunity to study her least favorite expression. Walt was wearing it now, as he looked up from his hand to study his opponent, as if the solution to whatever perplexed him might scroll across Horace's broad forehead, disgusting cyst and all. At moments like this, his brow tightly knit, his eyes narrowed, Walt Como always looked like he was trying to figure out not how his opponent happened to be winning so much as how he was cheating. And Janine wondered if this sly, distrustful expression might be responsible for his nickname. Certainly, it always made Janine want to take him aside and explain exactly how he was being cheated. "He's smarter than you, Walt," she'd have liked to tell him. "He's cheating you by remembering what cards you've played and what cards he's played. That's how he knows what's left in the deck. He pays attention to what you're doing and to what it means. It's not a damn marked deck, and he doesn't have an accomplice, and there's no mirror behind you reflecting your cards. He's just smarter than you. It might not be fair, but he is." Miles, bad as he was, had been a far better card partner. He had no poker face at all, and he couldn't help looking surprised when Lady Luck smiled on him, and disappointed when she didn't. But at least he was more often a step ahead of the game than a step behind, like the Silver Fox. To Janine, one of life's crueler ironies was that Miles, who often could locate the Queen of Spades two tricks into a game of hearts, hadn't been able to find her spot in 20 years of marriage. Janine counted Mississippis and got to 10 before Walt decided what to discard, which ginned Horace nicely. Walt, ever curious, turned over the card Horace had laid face down, groaning when he saw what it was. "You lucky bastard," he said. "That was my damn gin card." "I knew that, Mr. Como," Horace explained, totaling up the points he'd caught Walt with.
Why do you suppose I wouldn't give it to you? Thus released from his torment, Walt rotated on his stool and took in the woman who would soon be his wife, breaking into a wide grin. This, Jeanine realized, as Walt looked her over, was why she was marrying the man. He might be a beat slow, all right, several beats slow, but damn if he wasn't always glad to see her. He always drank her in with what seemed to be fresh eyes, and she didn't really care if the reason for this might be short-term memory deficiency. Walt's appreciation made her glow inside, opening her up, allowing her spot to unfold like the soft petals of a flower, so obviously that even Miles could have found it. Not that he'd ever have the opportunity again. "Hey, good-looking," Walt said. "Good thing Big Boy isn't here. He'd commit Harry Carey seeing how good you look." Having given voice to this pleasantly dark thought, Walt turned to Horace for a second opinion. "How'd you like to go through the rest of your life knowing you had a woman this beautiful and lost her?" Horace was either still totaling up their score on his notepad or pretending to, forcing Walt to rotate back on his stool. "Let me guess," he said. 122. Well, sure, okay. Here was another thing that irritated Jeanine, this constant public guessing game about her weight. Not that she wasn't proud of having dropped the 50 pounds, and she knew, too, that Walt did it because he was proud of her. Still, it reminded her a little of that midway trick back when she was a girl, the booth where they guessed people's weights. 123. Pleased, in spite of herself, she grinned at him. "But can we not have this conversation in public?"
123, Walt bellowed. "I'm going to get that scale in the women's locker room checked out."
And again he rotated on his stool and nudged Horace.
"How about it, though? 123. Guess how much she weighed when we met."
"I'd be real careful," Jeanine advised Horace, who looked like he didn't need to be warned.
"Don't be like that," Walt said. "You should be proud." Then rotating back to Horace, mid-180s.
"You want anything, Jeanine?" David called over his shoulder from where he was browning a roast, without, of course, actually looking at her.
"No, I'm fine," she told him. "Tick almost done back there?"
"Pretty close." Still not looking up from his work, the prick.
"Tell her I'm here, okay?"
"She knows you're here." The implication being what? That the kid could smell it when she came in? Or that Jeanine's appearance altered the whole atmosphere?
"Can you believe this woman?" Walt now asked. "No, I sure wouldn't want to be that brother of yours, knowing I let a woman this good-looking get away from me."
"She's a beauty, all right," David agreed.
"Hear that?" Walt said, nuzzling Jeanine's neck. "Everybody says the same thing."
Jeanine had heard what her brother-in-law said, heard it a lot clearer than the silver fox had, and she leaned away from his cold nose. At home, she might have enjoyed the affection, but not here, especially with people making sarcastic remarks. To show David who was boss, she got up and went around the counter to the register, hit no sale, and the drawer flew open. "I'm changing a 50 here, David," she called. "That all right with you? Since I'm a former employee and all-around beauty queen?"
"If it's all right with Miles," he said, "I just work here." Which pissed her off even more.
"You can come over and watch if you want."
Charlene stepped up just then, snatched the 50 and quickly made change out of the drawer, then slammed it by way of punctuation.
"How you doing, Jeanine?"
"Just fine, Charl."
She wadded up the bills and stuffed them in her purse, feeling robbed of some vague satisfaction. She hadn't needed change for the 50 to begin with. The good news, she thought, watching Charlene arranging tables for tonight's private party, was that at 45, Charlene was finally showing her age. Since her operation, she looked tired, and a little fan of lines had appeared at the corners of her eyes and was deepening there. By the look of her, she'd also put on about 10 pounds, which made Jeanine wonder how much longer her soon-to-be ex-husband would continue mooning over her. That would be a hard habit for him to break, having been at it his entire married life. In matters of the heart, Miles was even more transparent than when he was playing cards. When it came to what he was holding close to his vest, he'd just hang on to it, tight as grim death, and deny it was there, no matter how hard you tried to pry it out of him. When Charlene finished rearranging tables, Janine couldn't help but smile. Another year or two, and that's going to be one fat ass, lady, she thought. Drape it with a sheet and show home movies. This last weekend, Janine had noticed, the college boys returning for the fall semester hadn't been quite as flirtatious, and this year they actually seemed more interested in their own dates than in peeking down Charlene's shirt. Next year, even the salesman who pushed dollies full of canned goods into the back, calling out mock invitations for her to join them in the walk-in cooler for a minute, would stop treating her like she was sex on the hoof. And then that would leave just Miles in love with her. And not really her, either, but the woman she was before she wore out. The woman he still believed her to be, against the testimony of his own eyes. There, Janine thought, now I've thoroughly depressed myself. Because the truth was she liked Charlene, who'd had four bad marriages and her own share of heartache, and never once during the years that Janine and Miles were married had she encouraged his crush any more than she encouraged the college boys. It was her body that drew them, and she couldn't help that. While it was pleasurable to consider that Janine was winning her own body war at about the same rate that Charlene was losing hers, Janine was too smart not to see the end of all this, which was that they would both lose. The competition for the love and admiration of men like Walt and Miles would be passed like a torch to some other girl, some kid, really, who'd look at Janine and Charlene and never even suspect that they'd been there and done that. The sad fucking truth was that no matter who you are, you never ever will get your fill. In full possession of this wisdom, Janine slipped her left hand beneath the counter and into the front trouser pocket of the Silver Fox, who smiled slyly and slowly rose to the occasion. That Walt was 50 did worry her a little. She was getting started late, orgasm-wise, and it'd be just her luck for Walt to shut down early. He wasn't exactly leaping to attention at the moment, but he was getting there. Down at the other end of the restaurant, there was a table full of young women from the Dexter County Academy of Hair Design, who came in most afternoons a few minutes before closing and hunkered down in the far booth, chattering and whispering and eating pie. Studying these girls, she wondered if one of them might be the next Charlene, the next Janine. A couple were almost pretty if you imagine them without the big hair and the extra pounds that already, in their early 20s, were weighing them down. No, maybe Janine's days, like Charlene's, were numbered, but at least there didn't seem to be much competition on the immediate horizon, which meant that for a while she'd have the field, such as it was, to herself. Janine was smiling when the door to the kitchen swung open and her daughter appeared, announcing that she was ready to go home. Walt, apparently forgetting there was a friendly hand in his front trouser pocket, damn near leapt off his stool, twisting Janine's wrist in the process. "There she is," he cried, ignoring his fiancée's distress. "There's our little beauty!"
Chapter 4. In art class, the five long rectangular tables are all color-coded, 7 or 8 students at each, and Tick has been assigned to blue. Mrs. Rodrigue, the art teacher, is a large woman with a massive shelf of a bosom, of which she appears to have no knowledge. When she enters the classroom and one of the boys says, all too audibly, "Bazoom!" she never seems to connect her own appearance with this too predictable utterance. Though Mrs. Rodrigue is about Tick's father's age, she seems older, perhaps because she wears her hair in a style that Tick associates only with elderly women. As a teacher, what Mrs. Rodrigue prides herself most on is her organization. "There are 40 of you," she told the class after they were all seated that first day, "and so it will be imperative that we get organized and stay organized." Normally, classes are not allowed to grow so large, but an exception is made for art. Unspoken acknowledgement, Tick suspects, that nobody considers art to be a real course, like history or math. Mrs. Rodrigue isn't even full-time, teaching afternoons at the high school, mornings at the middle school. Her teaching strategies identical regardless of her audience. For Tick, the interesting thing about Mrs. Rodrigue's color coding is that the tables themselves are all steel gray. So the only way to differentiate blue from red that first day was to read the signs. Blue, green, red, yellow, and brown. Carefully lettered in black ink, taped to each. On the second day, all the signs came down and were slipped into plastic baggies before they could be dirtied or wrinkled. Art, she told her students, was the study and practice of order. There was no such thing as sloppy art. Artists, she claimed, first had to know where they were, and in Mrs. Rodrigue's class, the first thing you learned was whether you were blue or green, and so forth. If you were blue, you were supposed to remember where blue was, though why blue was blue and not, for instance, a number, like one or two, remained a mystery. Nonetheless, at the blue table, Tick sits next to Candace Burke, who favors trendy, girly clothes, baggy jeans, tight shirts, pink Adidas shoes, also white eyeshadow and lots of mascara. Today she's wearing her unicorn t-shirt. Either she's got two of these, or she washes the one right after she's worn it. She'd worn it the first day of school, and now Thursday she's wearing it again. "Oh my God, oh my God," she exclaims, looking at Tick's painting. "You're almost done. I haven't even started. Help me, okay? What's my most vivid dream?" "I don't know any of your dreams," Tick points out. Candace shrugs, as if to suggest that that makes two of them, but this problem occupies her for no more than a split second. "So, how come you're in here with the morons?" is what she'd really like to know. Though Candace has asked this every day and been answered too, she either keeps forgetting or else is suspicious of the answer she's been given. Her persistence reminds Tick of a movie she saw once in which a man was interrogated for hours, asked all sorts of questions, but one question in particular over and over. His answer was always the same, but his questioners must have suspected something, because they kept coming back to that one question. Finally, they killed him, out of frustration, apparently. You never found out whether the man was telling the truth or not. Candace is openly using an X-Acto knife she stole during the first day of class, carving the name of her boyfriend, Bobby, into the back of the wooden chair she's turned around and is sitting in the way older men sometimes do in the Empire Grill. Tick's proximity to this dangerous-looking instrument and the use to which it is being put are making her more than a little nervous, especially when Candace stops carving and gestures with the blade for dramatic emphasis. Tick half expects her to put the knife to her throat and hiss, "Why are you really in here with the morons? Who sent you? Tell me the truth or I'll..." What Candace is trying to reconcile is that Tick is a high-track kid, whereas she herself and all the rest are bones, kids who take the lower-track versions of required courses like biology, along with guaranteed GPA boosters like art. One reason Candace has befriended her, Tick suspects, is that she enjoys showing strangers around Bone World, an academic sphere populated by those who can't learn grammar or solve math problems, and see no reason why they should. The majority are boys, who don't at all mind being referred to as boners. Candace herself prefers moron. She confessed to Tick that it's also her mother's favorite word, one she applies to Candace on a wide variety of occasions, such as, "What's up, moron?" or, "You learn anything in school today, moron?" or, "Hey, moron, you didn't walk off with my goddamn car keys again, did you?" or, "I swear to fucking Christ, moron, I catch you in the damn liquor cabinet again, I'm gonna take you out of where you are and put you in Mount Calvary with the damn Christians, let you drink the blood of the Lamb for a while and see how well you like that shit, and I can tell you right now you won't, so just stay out of my fucking vodka." As far as Tick can tell, Candace has concluded that the word is a term of endearment applied to kids like herself who happen, everyone seems to agree, to have no future. Still, Tick wonders if she should voice her objection to the moron label before explaining why she happens to be among those thus classified. But since Candace doesn't appear to expect this, she decides not to. I like art, Tick says weakly, just as she has every day this week, aware, as always, that the truth isn't much of a substitute for a good answer. Tick almost didn't take art because it wouldn't fit into her schedule, being offered only at times when the high-track kids had required courses, like chemistry and calculus, or were at lunch. When Tick proposed that she could take art if she were allowed to eat lunch in the cafeteria during sixth period, the idea was vetoed until her father went with her to see the principal, Mr. Meyer, who pointed out that the cafeteria closed after fifth period. Even if Tick brought a sandwich with her and got a soda out of the machine, she'd have to eat it all by herself in the big empty cafeteria, which would be locked after she entered. And she'd be on her honor not to let anyone else in, because there would be no monitor. When Mr. Meyer asked Tick if she could live with these provisos, she wondered, as she so often did, at the strange world adults seemed to inhabit. Did they all suffer from some sort of collective amnesia? You had only to look at Mr. Meyer to know that he'd been the kind of fat kid everybody made fun of, and that lunch had surely been a torment to him. He'd either gravitated naturally to the leper table, or sat by himself at a table designed for 16, a target for all the kids overcrowding the cool tables, the tables that were identified as cool by who had the right to sit at them. Codes established the first day of school, the rules clear to everyone. No need for color coding. You had only to look at Mr. Meyer to know he'd spent all his high school years getting hit in the back of the head with all manner of throwable food. Yet here he was, worried that Tick was going to miss out on the important socialization aspects of a good secondary education. Some damn thing must have hit him in the back of his pointed head pretty hard during one of those lunches, Tick decided, because the man honestly seemed to have no recollection of them. Therefore, he had no idea how thrilled Tick was at the prospect of eating lunch by herself. She didn't mind in the least waiting until sixth period to eat her sandwich. School twisted her stomach into knots anyway, and this way, at least, she wouldn't have to endure the humiliation of not having a place to sit, which certainly would have been her destiny. She'd broken up with Zach Minty over the summer, meaning she would no longer be welcome at the table dominated by his circle. And she knew better than to try to crash one of the cliques at the popular girls' table. Far better to be alone in an empty cafeteria, Tick thought, than to be alone in a full one.
Did you know Craig was going to buy me the Beatles anthology for my birthday? Candace wants to know now. Before I broke up with him, I mean.
Tick tries to ignore her. The first assignment is to paint your most vivid dream, and Tick's is the one where she's clutching a snake in her fist. The painting is going pretty well. The snake started out looking like an eel, but now it's less flat, more serpentine. Except it's not as scary as the snake in her dream, which, no matter how tight her grip, manages to squirm up to where it can turn and look at her. In the dream, she's safe as long as she can hold the snake up near its head, but each time it manages to slither through her grip. When it turns to look at her, she wakes up with a start. From this dream, Tick concludes that she's learned something useful. Whatever means you harm will look you over first.
Are you listening to me? Candace says.
Who's Craig? Tick asks, suspecting she's supposed to know that he's somebody Candace has mentioned before, probably more than once. The good news is that Candace never minds repeating boyfriend stories.
He's the one I broke up with for Bobby, she explains,
preferring this subject to the task of beginning her thumbnail sketch, which she will later be required to transfer to a large piece of paper and then finally to paint. It doesn't appear to bother Candace that she's behind everybody in the class. More interesting, it doesn't seem to bother Mrs. Rodrigue either. All week long, Tick has been expecting the woman to come around to the blue table, see that Candace has done exactly nothing, and read her the riot act. But so far she's stayed strictly away,
as if she's already determined that blue is trouble and therefore doesn't exist. Most teachers, Tick has learned, feel no great compulsion to confront trouble. They're never around when drugs are being bought and sold, for example. The mystery of the X-Acto knife, stolen after the first art class, its theft announced over the loudspeaker during homeroom, would be solved if Mrs. Rodrigue ever visited Blue, where Candace openly uses it on her bobby carving. Tick can't help but wonder if Mrs. Rodrigue is as afraid of the knife as she is. Fear, often irrational, of the sort that paralyzes Tick, is something she'd like to think she'll outgrow. Adults, by and large, seem free of it. Even her Uncle David, whose car wreck nearly severed his arm at the elbow, seems almost carefree when he gets behind the wheel. No, most adults are more like her father, whose fear, if he feels any, has been replaced by a kind of melancholy. Her mother's a different story, though. Sometimes Tick sees a fleeting look of panic on Janine's face when she doesn't know she's being observed, but then she swallows hard and subdues whatever it is by sheer force of will. That's a trick Tick would be glad to learn, because dread is her more or less constant companion.
So, should I wait for my boyfriend? Candace wants to know, or go back with Craig for a couple weeks?
Bobby, the one Candace may or may not wait for, is in jail. He was arrested at Fairhaven High, according to Candace, and it was not a righteous bust. Why she thinks this is not clear to Tick. Candace actually seems to believe the cops came for him because he took a dollar from his mother and only paid back 75 cents. Supposedly, he'll be released in a couple weeks in time for homecoming. Tick doesn't know how much of what Candace tells her is true. She's not sure, for instance, if the boy is really in jail, or if he exists at all, or if the other boy, Craig, ever really promised to buy her the Beatles anthology. Vagaries of this sort make it hard to give good advice. If she's to be believed, Candace has a very dramatic love life, which is fine with Tick, except that when she has finally exhausted the subject of her own romances, she'll want to know about Tick's, which are singularly lacking in drama. Or maybe just singularly lacking. On Martha's Vineyard, she met a shy boy from Indiana who was visiting friends with his mother while her divorce from the boy's father became final. If Tick were to steal an X-Acto knife and carve a boy's name in the back of her chair, the name would be Donnie. When he told her about his father, who was moving to California, his eyes filled with tears. His father was moving right then, that very week, and Donnie had been packed off to Martha's Vineyard, he confided, so he wouldn't have to watch him leave home. Donnie also told her he'd have preferred to live with his dad, even though he was the one at fault for falling in love with another woman. Tick told him that this had been pretty much her experience, too. After her parents split up, nobody had asked her who she wanted to live with. Of course, in her case, nobody was moving to California. And although she technically was living with her mother, she spent almost as much time with her father. Donnie found it hard to believe that Tick's mother and father still lived about 3 blocks from each other. His father, apparently, had selected San Diego as his new home because it was as far from Indianapolis as you could get without leaving the continental United States. Tick explained that her parents probably just didn't have enough money to put much distance between themselves. This intimate conversation had taken place on the beach on their last night together, and Donnie had taken her hand as they watched the orange sun plunge into the ocean. They hadn't even found the courage to kiss, and early the next morning, when they'd said their goodbyes, they'd shaken hands there in front of Tick's father and Donnie's mother. Unsure that anything more would be allowed them, their fingers icy cold with disappointment. Anyway, it wasn't much of a story to tell someone like Candace, even if Tick had been inclined to share it. She suspected it mostly was evidence of her own stunted emotional and romantic development, as was the fact that she couldn't seem to stop thinking about how good it had been to sit there on the warm sand in the gathering dusk and just hold hands with a boy she liked. Sure, she wished now that they'd found the courage to kiss, but at the time, they'd both been content. Their mutual understanding, even though it was an understanding of grief,
had at first been thrilling, then quietly reassuring, though she doubted Candace would have seen it that way. She already had made several references to going down on Bobby. Tick was almost sure she knew what going down on a boy meant, and if she was right, Candace wouldn't be impressed by an encounter that climaxed with hand-holding.
I mean, Craig's not so bad, and he loves me and everything, and he really wants to buy me the Beatles anthology, so, like, what should I do?
Candace wants to know. Before Tick can say anything, they're interrupted by a boy named Justin, who's sitting at the far end of their table.
What, Candace? He says, pretending she'd spoken to him. You say you want to make out with John?
John Voss, also at the blue table, never even looks up. Of all the kids at Empire High, he seems to Tick the most unknowable, and for this reason, he scares her a little. It isn't so much his strange thrift shop clothes or his haircut and patches, as if he'd done the job himself. It's his silence. So far this week, he hasn't spoken a word. Were he not referred to every now and then by Justin, who pretends to narrate the comatose boy's thoughts, everyone would forget he is even there. John Voss is painting something elaborately filigreed in the shape of an egg, which is also confusing and frightening Tick. Who dreams of eggs? Watching him work makes Tick think of analogies of the sort she encounters on standardized tests. This one would read, John is to Justin as blank is to Candace. The answer would be Tick.
John says you should come over to his house today after school, Candace. He says he's got something he'd like to show you.
Shut up, you asshole, Candace shouts, startling Tick.
The panic in her voice results, Tick knows, from Justin's attempt to link her romantically with this boy who is at the very bottom of the high school's social hierarchy. Since Candace isn't so far from the bottom herself, she must guard against any misunderstanding of this sort.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Rodrigue, she says when everyone from red, green, yellow, and brown turns to look at her, but he is always embarrassing me.
Mrs. Rodrigue has indeed straightened up and is now glaring at Blue, as if everyone at the table were equally responsible for Candace's outburst. Her disappointment and displeasure seem to include, for instance, Tick herself and John Voss, who still hasn't even looked up from his egg.
I hope, the teacher intones, that we will have no more outbursts from the blue table. I said I'm sorry, Candace responds audibly, rolling her eyes as if to suggest that it's hard for her to imagine what the woman could possibly want from her that she hasn't already given.
If you require a model for acceptable behavior, Mrs. Rodrigue continues, as if she imagines that this might truly be the problem, you need look no further than green.
The green table, Tick notes, is decimated by absenteeism today. Normally it has 8 students, but 4 are missing. 2 of those present are reading their algebra books in preparation for a test next period, and another is fast asleep with his head on the table. If she didn't know better, Tick would like to raise her hand and ask Mrs. Rodrigue precisely what it is about the green table that's so worthy of emulation. Even Candace, using a stolen X-Acto knife to carve her jailed boyfriend's name in ornate letters, memorializing her affection for a juvenile delinquent and thereby defacing school property, comes closer to fulfilling the implied objectives of an art course.
So, how come you broke up with Zach Minty? Candace asks,
once Mrs. Rodrigue has returned her attention to the creative efforts of the favored red table.
We kind of broke up with each other, Tick says. Which is true in a way. When she told Zach she didn't want to go out with him anymore, he'd said fine, that he didn't want to go out with her anymore either. Like, who did she think she was anyway? He'd called the next day to tell her he'd already had a new girlfriend, naming a girl who seemed to hate Tick, despite their never having exchanged a word.
I think you should get back together with him, Candace says, apparently uninhibited by knowing virtually nothing about the relationship. I mean, he still really loves you.
Tick swallows hard, tries to concentrate on her snake, which suddenly feels wrong in some way she can't exactly put her finger on. True, it is looking less like an eel, which is good, but there's something definitely wrong about its proportions, as if the lower part of its body were drawn to one scale and the upper, including its head, to another. She wishes she could justify this as perspective. A lot of bad art, it seems to her, gets excused as intentional.
I doubt it, Tick says, resorting to the absolute, unadorned truth this time.
The odd thing was that before she went to the vineyard, she hadn't known what to do about Zack. Summer was one thing, but it was much harder to be friendless during the school year, when, as a friendless person, you were not constantly on display. Now, though, in September, it was different. Losing Zack wasn't so bad in itself. At least she didn't have to wonder every day what kind of mood he was in, whether he'd be nice or mean, his behavior about as predictable as the wind. So being without a boyfriend was okay, even though she doubted she'd find another one anytime soon. What worried her more than losing Zack was losing his friends, the whole Zack network. While they were together, his friends had been her friends. But as soon as they broke up, she discovered the truth, that they were his friends, every one of them. Not that they disliked her. She suspected that a couple of them actually liked her better than they liked Zack, or would have been happy to remain neutral, had the rules permitted any such thing. But they didn't. And Zack wasn't someone you wanted for an enemy. Right away, she'd started getting calls from his friends urging her to get back together with him, hinting that she wouldn't be welcome in their group otherwise. A couple of the boys sounded almost afraid, like they couldn't imagine the kind of recklessness she was contemplating. One of the girls even volunteered that Zack might be willing to break up with his new girlfriend if Tick came back, maybe, though it wasn't for sure. Until Martha's Vineyard, she'd seriously considered doing so, but now she was pretty sure she couldn't. After being with a boy who actually liked her, she was willing to be friendless, at least for now. What saddened her was the cost of this new knowledge. Could it be that getting the taste of affection, so sweet and new, from somebody who wasn't your father or mother, meant that she'd have to forego other companionship entirely?
I mean, he totally does not care about Heather, Candace is saying. You should, like, see the way he treats her.
I know how he treats her, Tick says, studying her snake critically. What it needs, she decides, is a tongue. It's how he used to treat me.
He's changed, Candace says, looking at her now.
She stopped carving entirely and is gathering up her things in anticipation of the bell. Her sudden interest in Tick's romantic life confirms what Tick has been fearing, that Candace is befriending her because she was specifically commissioned by Zack to sound her out on the subject of a possible reconciliation. Tick has seen blessedly little of him since school began, but that's because of football practice, which he has to attend every day after classes. If it weren't for that, he would have been tormenting her nonstop. The other thing saving her is that Zack screwed up so badly last year that he was booted out of the high track course